Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Drill in the gap, right center field. That'll get down and go to the wall. The Indians will score first once again. Santana around third comes home. Jason Kipnis with his 23rd double of the year, and that has to feel really good for him. Oh, this time Urshela yanks it down the left field line. Jay Bruce scores a go-ahead run. Kipnis into third. Mike Sarbaugh puts the brakes on him there. It's an RBI double with two outs for Gio Urshela, and the Indians take a 2-1 lead.
How about that for clutch hitting? Happening during the course of the game.
Lindor launches one deep center. Back is Trout. He's out of room. It's out of here. Frankie Lindor with a big blast into the cheap seats. A two-run homer here in the seventh to make it 4-2 Cleveland. His 31st home run of the year.
It's almost like he knew it was coming.
And the payoff pitch is shot to left field. A base hit. And that's going to bring Jackson around to score. Jose Ramirez digging for two. The throw is in time, and he is out.
What a great job of hitting that one.
Shaw, 2-2 pitch. Swung out and missed. He struck him out to end the game. The Indians have their 95th victory of the season. They've won 26 of their last 27, and a new franchise record with their 13th consecutive win on the road.
And I hate that comment where people say they stay within themselves, because you can stay within yourself and right out of leg like me. But when you have talent, the moment's not too big for him. You see, it seems like you see the best of his talent. I know we feel good when he comes up. We did a lot of good things tonight, because I thought they did a lot of good things. I mean, that was a fun game to be a part of. That looked like two teams that really wanted to win.
It's coordinated. I mean, that's a big part of our getting ready for this game, is the continual growth of pass defense, of execution of our pass game, of playing with rhythm and tempo on offense. Those are all areas that's part of our game plan. So to answer your question, it's a mix of both. They're primarily a four-down defense. We haven't seen that in a couple weeks. Getting ready for that because it's a new defense, and then also just working our weaknesses. And it's good to have both. You know, I've had that before. We have different skill sets at quarterback, and they're somewhat different. I don't know if it's drastically different, but somewhat different. So we just have, the good thing is we have it all. It's just getting them ready to, so when you script plays, okay, Dwayne, you're in, and go. And Joe Burrow's, he's about 90%. He's been cleared to play. He's still not 100%, but he's involved in all. And he's probably in between the skill sets.
We had our hands full. That's mainly what we're focusing on right now. Coming up with that plan and then implementing it today in meetings and in practice. A big challenge for us. The whole team's playing really good. Yeah, you just do. You just change the channel. We're going from one scheme to another. Change our scheme to adapt, improvise, adjust. Go with the guy that's got the hot hand. You've seen us. That's what we've done with the running back position. Ty's a starter. Chris and Karan are gonna play in every single game. So, yeah, I don't see it as the same as the quarterback position or the punt return position.
What did you like about winning the game on Saturday?
We won. That's his number one job. I took care of the football. Made some courageous throws in the pocket, accurate throws in tight windows, and you know, a lot of things.
Welcome to the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Welcome indeed to the Extravaganza right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket, where we are, Toledo's sports leader. Hope you're having an outstanding Thursday. Yeah, that's good to hear. Very, very good to hear. And, you know, why not cheer? Why not cheer and scream and celebrate for just all the winning that's going on? Remember when Donald Trump said, when I'm president, we're going to win so much you're going to get tired of winning? I don't think he meant the Cleveland Indians, but they took it to heart. Not that he has anything to do with it. No, I'm not going politics. I'm just pointing out it's kind of a fun thing. I mean, do you ever get tired of winning? So much winning going on with the Cleveland Indians. Kush, last night, would have been the record breaker.
Yeah.
26 out of 27 now for the Cleveland Indians. Had they not tripped on Friday in the game against the Royals, last night would have been 27 in a row, and it would have set the all-time record for any era in baseball history. of 27 straight wins. So as it stands, they'll have to settle, poor little, you know, hard luck losers. They'll have to settle for the American League's longest winning streak at 22, the second longest in baseball history, and now a run of 26 out of their last 27 games, as well as a franchise record 13 straight road victories as they took down the Angels again last night.
Yeah, and with the little streak over, the only thing that should matter is the fact it's still, as of this moment, game and a half over Houston, which in practice is really two and a half because they have the tiebreaker.
Yes, they do. That's exactly right. And the Dodgers, did they win last night? Because the Dodgers had lost three in a row. They continue to allow the Indians to creep toward them, potentially, for the, you know, the best record in all of baseball. You know, we know they have that huge long 11-game losing streak, did the Dodgers.
No, the Dodgers lost to the Phillies, and they're playing right now, and the Phillies just took a lead, so it could be down to, believe it or not, half game.
Holy mackerel. What an unbelievable fall for the Dodgers. They lost, what, 11 in a row and 15 out of 16 before breaking the 11-in-a-row streak. And then they kind of won and lost, and now they're on another losing streak of four in a row. They are 96-56. The Indians are 95-57. So it's one game right now. And as Jim said, the Dodgers are currently trailing. They're playing right now 4-3 bottom six. There it is. 4-3 bottom six in Philadelphia. The Dodgers are trailing. So it could be just a half game. By the end of the night tonight, the Indians, if they take care of the Angels again. Although I don't feel good about tonight, by the way, Kush, because it's Danny Salazar time. They threw him in to kind of make this a bit of a six-man rotation for the time being, just to give everybody kind of an extra day's rest, everybody that's in the real rotation. So Salazar goes tonight, and that might mess up the routine, if you will. And he just, quite frankly, has not been good. So we'll see if they can make it three in a row and sweep the Angels. And actually tied the Dodgers by the end of the night for the best record in all of baseball. So that's a little baseball to get us started today. Lots of winning going on out there in Cleveland. There's lots of winning going on in Ann Arbor as well. And we want to dive. We got a lot of stuff to do today. We're going to talk football with some of the best football voices that you're going to hear really in the country. Coming up at 4:10, the voice of the Buckeyes Radio Network, Paul Keels, will join us to talk about Ohio State football and their matchup with UNLV. Should be pretty much a cakewalk. But for the Michigan Wolverines, no cakewalk at all. It is Big Ten time as they take on Purdue at Purdue. And joining us now is the voice of the Michigan IMG Sports Network, play-by-play man extraordinaire, Jim Brandstetter, right here on ESPN 106.5, The Ticket in Toledo. Jim, thanks so much for your time. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, thank you, and I'm glad to join you. And tell Paul Keels I said hello, would you?
I will be happy to do that. Yeah, we talk with Paul every week, and I'd love to set it up. I don't want to put you on the spot on live radio, but if you want to talk with us every week, my God, our Michigan fans down here in Toledo would love to hear your voice.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. With the Lions and everything I'm doing, it's like I can't hardly commit to every week. But I'll get down there on occasion. You give me a call, we can get on there on occasion.
Well, we certainly appreciate when we can get you, Jim. So thanks very much, and I understand that schedule. Okay, speaking of schedules, it's a pretty good one thus far for Jim Harbaugh. Although, you know, I mean, let's just before we start talking about Purdue and the start of Big Ten play. Jim, let's talk about the last couple of weeks. I mean, I think everybody was very impressed with the week one win, a battle of top 25 teams over Florida, 33-17. You know, the question of who was going to guide this team under center was answered as Wilton Spate came back out to keep the job that he had last year. But the last couple of weeks, though, victories, a little underwhelming, particularly on the offensive side of the ball. The defense looks like it's among the best in the country. Uh-huh. On the offensive side, it looks like a lot of young guys working in with Wilton, a young receiving core, young backfield. I mean, crying out loud, the whole roster is young after everybody that they lost. Let's talk about that, Jim. Can you give us your impression of what we saw in weeks two and three against Cincinnati and Air Force and the development overall of this offense?
Well, I think they're beginning to get there. I think you need to have more consistent play from your quarterback, Wilton Spate. But I think, too, you mentioned it, a lot of young kids. I mean, Tariq Black, Donovan Peoples-Jones. Now, Tariq Black's going to be out because he's had surgery. But, you know, Spate's working with a brand-new receiving core. You know, they lost Chesson, Darbo, and Jake Butt a year ago. And those guys made a lot of plays. And this year, it's a little bit different. Running game's a little different. Three new starters in the offensive line. So it's going to take a while for them to, I think, come together a little bit. Yeah, I think most everybody will tell you that they've kind of been underperforming given what you thought they might be. But when you really take a step back and look, you go, well, you know, maybe they're still young. They're growing together. I think Jim's a good offensive coach, though, and I think that sooner or later this team's going to, I think, start to put it together and be more consistent. Well, they have to be if they're going to try to win the Big Ten.
There's no doubt about that. Now let's talk about what you just said about them starting a little bit slow. I wonder if this isn't a little bit by design. And what I mean by that is Jim Harbaugh knows full well how young the receiving core is, how different the backfield is, and so on and so forth. He probably didn't expect to come out going great guns with everything he thinks they can do in week two against Cincinnati or week three. Is the offense as stagnant because of growing pains, Jim, that sometimes it looks like? Or is Jim Harbaugh just kind of easing the guys into it? It's not stagnant because of their ability.
He's not unfurling
the entire playbook right now.
No, I think he would like to have his foot all the way down on the pedal.
Okay.
I just don't think that they have gotten where they need to go yet. All the things working together. In order to be good offensively, you got to have 11 guys on the same page working together. Nobody can miss a block, and you can't, you know, overthrow passes and touchdown passes and things like that, and third down plays, you got to convert those, and those are the things that they're not doing. But they will. I think Jim's going to have them doing that. But, and don't forget, too, you know, the Florida game, is as good as that victory was, the offense didn't light it up, really. I mean, they had a couple of really big plays. They ran the ball efficiently, but they ran the ball efficiently in all their games. It's just that, you know, the inconsistency. You expect three or four drives together to go out and you get a 28-0 lead and you kind of coast. And that hasn't been the case. And I think that's what everybody's looking at.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, too. Jim Brandstatter joining us. He is the voice of the Michigan Wolverines, and we're talking about the Wolverines, and we'll get to Purdue in just a second. Let me ask one more thing about Wilton Spate. You know, he's a little bit under the gun. Because, well, he won what was thought to be a pretty well-contested quarterback battle between John O'Korn, the fifth-year senior, and then, you know, a redshirt freshman who's never done anything yet, obviously. So maybe he was the logical choice. And when the offense sputters, the eyes all go to him. We know, though, from watching football long enough time, somebody like you, a quarterback's mistakes aren't always a quarterback's mistakes. It might be a receiver who broke off a route at the wrong place in the wrong time or did not run it at the right depth or whatever the case might be. Is Spate getting a fair shake from the critics in your mind, given that young receiving core he's got to find chemistry with?
You know what? I don't think quarterbacks, rarely do I think they get a fair shake. You've heard the old saying, they get too much credit when it goes well and too much blame when it goes down. I think that's probably a little bit true. But you know what? I think if you ask Wilton right now, he'd say, I got to play better. I mean, I think you can add that to the mix in regards to, you know, what they're doing offensively. But I think he's got a lot of pressure on him. I think people have seen him for a year. I think defensive coordinators have a look at Jim Harbaugh's offense and know kind of what's coming. And they've made it a little bit more difficult on Wilton Spate, getting him in and out of plays. And the other thing is, don't forget, there's three new offensive linemen over there. A new center, new right guard, new right tackle. And, you know, we, against Florida, we had a lot of negative plays where, you know, you were second and 12. You know, I don't care who you are. If you put a quarterback in second and 12 and third and 14, you know, he's going to have a rough time. And so I think it's a little bit of all those things. But I think really if you ask Wilton Spate, he'd tell you, you know what, I need to be better. And I think he will be before it's all over.
Jim, as young as the offense is, and with a number of first-year starters, the defense, same situation. In fact, even more so. 10 starters were lost on defense after last season, and yet the defense seems to be just clicking on almost all cylinders. Well, maybe not. Rashawn Gary made a very interesting comment a couple of days ago. He said, the best is yet to come. We can get a lot better. How much better can, I mean, obviously I expect he's right. We're only in, you know, week four. But how impressed are you with this defense thus far, and how much better can it be, Jim?
Very impressed. And the thing is, I think that 10 new starters is a bit of a misnomer. I mean, let's face it, Devin Bush played a lot last year on special teams. Mm-hmm. Chase Winovich played a lot last year. Brian Monet played a lot last year. Rashawn Gary played a lot last year. The only guys that really I don't think have played a lot were Noah Furbush And maybe, the safeties all played. I mean, Kennel, Metalis, and Khalik Hudson have all played. The corners, LeVert Hill, Brandon Watson, and David Long, maybe the inexperienced ones. But overall, I mean, that defense has got a lot of time on the field. Let me just put it that way. And
yeah,
can they be better?
Listed as, they weren't listed as depth chart starters.
Right,
so
right.
Speaking, they're new starters, but you're right.
They're new starters. You're absolutely right. But they play. They know what they're doing. It's their second year in Don Brown's system. So it's not like they're walking in as true freshmen and they've never seen the field before. So from that perspective, I'm very impressed with how they've played. I'm not impressed necessarily with, I think the thing that Gabby's there, they have learned the system so well. When you play that fast, you can't think about it. It's instinctive. And to me, that's what has been impressive, is the fact that the complex schemes that Brown has, they are flying. And that means that they're really well coached, that they know what they're doing, they know where to line up, and they know where to go. And as soon as that ball is snapped, they're off. Because a lot of times when you get an inexperienced group, think about it first and then go. And when you do that, you're not as fast. So from my perspective, what I think about the defense, I think that they're really good. The only issue is I don't think they're as deep. Remember last year, it was Gary who was coming in and replacing Wormley.
Right.
Now you don't have that. Wormley was a kid from Toledo. And you don't have that anymore. And so they're playing a little bit more snaps. But from a pure talent standpoint, getting after it, this defense can get the job done.
We're talking to Jim Pratt-Satter, the voice of the Michigan Wolverines. Michigan going into Big Ten play now against Purdue at Purdue. And this is not a pushover by any stretch of the imagination. Not that anybody in the Big Ten, generally speaking, is. But Purdue is off to a decent start this season, and it is a road game, and it is going to be a sellout, and it is going to be loud. How do the Wolverines handle this?
I'll tell you what, Purdue is good. I'm glad to hear you say that. It's not a pushover. I watched them on tape, and man, they have done a great job, and they've got a ton of guys from transfers from junior college and graduate transfers who played at different colleges across the country, and really their talent level's gone up. And this David Blau is an outstanding quarterback. His numbers this year have been remarkable. How does Michigan fare? I think you bring it against Blau. You try to get him under pressure, make him uncomfortable. Because any quarterback, I don't care who he is, Tom Brady, Peyton Manning, name them all. If you can get them moving their feet and get after them and get them uncomfortable, they're not going to be as effective. To me, that's how you handle this offense. Get after David Blau. Stop the run, which Michigan can do. Their guys up front can do that. But then you got to really, I think, get after the quarterback. And if they can do that, then I think they're going to be all right.
There's no doubt they can put some points up on the board in their three games. They lost the season opener, Louisville, 35-28, and I want to talk about that in a second. Then put 44 on Ohio, and then 35 more on Missouri in their two wins. So they definitely can put points on the board. But what about their defense? Because those are some pretty decent numbers there. Holding Mizzou to three, but more importantly, staying within a touchdown of the extraordinarily high-powered, high-flying Lamar Jackson and Louisville team in the opener. This is going to be a difficult challenge for the Michigan offense to attack their defense.
There's no question. I mean, they're good. I mean, but that game against Louisville will get your attention, because remember, Louisville goes into the game against Clemson, who might be one of the best teams in the country, if not the best.
That's right.
With an idea that a lot of people thought they might win with a Heisman Trophy winner at quarterback.
I kind of thought they would, and they surprised me. Well,
yeah,
Clemson
surprised
me. I guess, really.
Yeah, Clemson, I think, showed me a lot.
Yeah,
that game they just dominated. But yeah, I mean that shows you Purdue can get up there with the big boys and play, and especially with an offense as dynamic as Louisville. And so, if you're Michigan, you got to go in there and say, "Look, we must control the ball." I think that's the big thing. Keep them out there on the field. That was the thing that I think hurt Missouri, is that one, Purdue got a big lead, and two, they stayed on the field forever. I mean, they were on the field for 43 minutes, and it was a hot day, and Purdue, Missouri's defense just couldn't handle it. Now, it's going to be hot in West Lafayette this week. So, if you're Michigan, I think you force that defense to be out there a little bit. They're very good. Again, they filled in key spots with guys from different programs that are coming in from JCs or graduates from other universities. One guy, I think, started 20-some games, McCollum, in the linebacker. I mean, he started like 20-some games at an FBS program in Western Kentucky. He's now playing outside linebacker for Purdue, and he's a darn good one.
Has a lot of experience and a good athlete. Yeah. No question about it.
So those are the things you got to do. You know, it's about talent, it's about matchups, and you got to block good people and make sure that you're not making mistakes or turning it over on the road.
Jim, last thing on the Wolverines, just real quickly on Quinn Norton. What a stud! He's being called a beast. He was the Big Ten Special Teams Player of the Week, and now there's reports that not just in practice and not just in pregame where he can get a running start, but they believe he can kick a 70-yard field goal in game play. You believe? I mean, how good is this kid?
He's very, very good. Last year in the spring game, he hit one from 50 something, I forget, and it went through the uprights about 2/3 of the way up. And the ball, when it hit his foot, you could hear it in the press box. I mean, great kickers have that speed at the ball. It's kind of like golf, you know, where you get the club head and it's going as fast as it can go right at impact. And that's what Nordine does. I've always said, you know, listening to kickers like Eddie Murray and Jason Hansen at the Lions, they would bring in, you know, camp kickers, they call them. Mm-hmm. And I could turn away and not even watch who was kicking the ball and knew when Hansen kicked it because the sound was different. And that's the sound you get from Nordine.
You made the golf comparison. That's a baseball comparison, too, which I'm sure you'd realize. There are guys
who will
tell you who's in the batting cage during BP with their back to it. You can just hear the difference that the bat makes on the ball. And you're saying he's just the way he kicks it.
Exactly.
Wow.
And you're right, you know, you talk about bat speed and the hitting zone and all that other stuff. Same thing is when you get, I can turn my back and I can tell you when the camp kicker kicked it and I can tell you when Jason Hansen kicked it. And with Nordine, it's the same thing. It just sounds bigger. There's a thump. The other guy hits it and it's kind of a slap. When Nordine hits it, there's a thump. And that gives you the idea that he's got all that energy and focus. And it's right there at the impact zone because, man, he hit two against Florida in his first game on the road on the biggest stage at 50 and 55. So he's already proven he can do it with the lights on, too.
No question about it. And by the way, you know, a lot of the haters made fun of Jim Harbaugh for the sleepover when he was trying to recruit Nordine. I think Harbaugh's getting the last laugh right now that everybody sees what this kid is doing even as a freshman.
It's like that old thing, right? What do you think of me now?
That's exactly right. Hey, Jim Brandstatter, real quick, just because we got you, and I know we brought you in to talk Michigan, and I know you got to go, but just give me one thought on, you know, the Lions matchup against the defending NFC champions who are flying high. No, pun intended there, but they are literally flying high the way they played against Green Bay last week. Big challenge for the 2-0 Lions. What do you think?
I agree completely. I think this is a measuring stick game. I think, you know, last year, by all rights, the Falcons probably should have been world champions. If it weren't for Tom Brady, the comeback and everything going wrong for the Falcons, everything going right for the Patriots in the second half, the Falcons are world champions. And it looks to me as though they're playing with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder.
They do.
And to me, that means that the Lions got them at home, but this to me is a bit of a measuring stick. The Lions, you know, want to know how good you got to be. They may get the chance to see it up close and personal this Sunday. It's going to be a great game, I think.
Do you think they're ready? Do you think they, you know, that, you know, they got after last week 5 sacks. They got after the Giants and got Eli. It's a different team, though, obviously. Matt Ryan runs it a different way, and he's a little bit younger than Eli. Can they do that kind of stuff against the Falcons defense? They've got such good receivers.
Yeah.
Against offense, beg your pardon.
I don't know. I mean, I hope so. I think that this team is good enough and believes it's good enough that they can compete and win the NFC North. And if that's your goal and that's what you think about yourself, then guess what? You've got to be able to play and beat other teams that are the top of their division. And that's Atlanta. So in my judgment, I mean, I think they can do it and I think they believe they can. Now, as we all know in the NFL, it's about show me on Sunday. And that's all that's left.
That's
because
exactly
I think
right.
they're good enough. I really do. I think they're good enough. But now it's time to show everybody.
How about our Jim Brandstetter sale today? Two for the price of one. Two game analyses for the price of one. We thought we were just talking Wolverines, but we got them on the Lions, too. I really, really think that's a good deal for us. Jim, thank you. Thank you so much. Have a great call at Purdue, and then, of course, up at Ford Field on Sunday. We look forward to hearing you on both.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much. Be well.
Thank you, sir. Be good. Jim Brandstetter, one of the great voices in college sports, quite frankly. I mean, you could just say in general in broadcasting, but I love him on the Michigan calls. I really do. And I love the fact that he and Paul Keels are good friends, too, because we're going to talk Buckeyes with Paul Keels coming up at about 4:10 or so, a little bit over there, half an hour from right now. But great stuff from Jim Brandstetter there on the Wolverines and the Lions with their showdown with the Falcons coming up on Sunday. All right, Jim Cushion, I think it's time for the stat.
ESPN 106.5 The Ticket presents the Wild Stat of the Day, brought to you by Buffalo Wild Wings, Wings, Beer, Sports.
Stat of the Day, Tuesday night, the Major League all-time record for home runs in a single season was broken. Despite all the home runs hit in 2017, no one team is expected to set the record for most home runs by a single team in a single season. That title still belongs to the 97 Mariners, who hit 264 homers that year. There have also been 16 teams in history that have hit 240 home runs in one season. The current team home run leader right now with a week and a half to go is the Orioles, who have 227. So they are balanced. They are spread out amongst all of Major League Baseball to set that single season record. So there you have it. It is your Buffalo Wild Wings Wild Stat of the Day. Coming up in about an hour, a little less than an hour, we're going to have another opportunity to qualify you for our European vacation flyaway, courtesy of the Ticket and our friends. And also coming up in this half hour, still to come, Sammy Hagar tickets for this coming Wednesday at the Toledo Zoo. All of that straight ahead. Paul Keel's coming up at 4:10 as we continue on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Be part of the extravaganza right now by calling 866-240-1065. Now back to the Bob France extravaganza on 106.5 The Ticket.
Buddy, back indeed, right here on The Ticket. Great football talk with the voice of the Wolverines, Jim Brandstetter. And coming up, more of a great football talk, or more football talking, with another great football voice, Paul Keels, voice of the Buckeyes, will be joining us at 4:10. You know who else has a great voice, Jim Cushlin?
Who's that?
I do. What the hell's the matter?
You? You didn't sound so good the other day, I'll tell you that.
No,
much.
No, I didn't. And that's why you were in for me, using your own golden tones on Monday. So that's true. No, but aside from our wonderful voices, Sammy Hagar's is pretty good, too. He's made a kind of a, you know, nice little modest career for himself through the years as one of the great all-time rocking frontmen. Sammy Hagar is going to be playing the Toledo Zoo on Wednesday, the 27th. And you know what I have here, Jim Cushlin?
You have some tickets, don't you?
I have two tickets to that concert at the zoo on Wednesday. If you would like them, be caller number four right now. Caller four, 866-240-1065. 866-240-1065. And we'll set you up with Sammy Hagar tickets for Wednesday at the zoo. Good luck to you. So while Jim takes those phone calls, I want to get into something a little bit different. Pivot here to the tragedy last night. It was just simply, you know, one of those gut punch moments, one of those, oh, you just feel so sick to your own stomach. Even though you don't know the person involved, you just know what happened. And of course, I'm speaking of the 2-year-old girl, 2 years old, two, toddler, baby. One of the most horrific things that, that you can possibly see at a baseball game. Line drive, down the line. Off the bat of Todd Frazier, one of the great guys in baseball. Honestly, one of the very best people in baseball. And as he was visibly shaken yesterday when that line drive down the third base line went off of the face, the head of a little girl, you could see how upset he was. You could see how upset everyone was. All of the players, fielders, hitters, dugout, everybody got on a knee and probably gave prayer for the little girl who was immediately taken out of the ballpark and into the hands of waiting medical personnel. And the players were upset. Matt Holliday was wiping tears from his face. Other fans did the same. players did the same. Certainly fans in the area were just so sickened by what they saw. I will tell you this, in all truthfulness, I didn't see it. I know about it, of course, and I've read all of the descriptions of it, and I've read all of the commentary about it. And, of course, the big discussion point now is what baseball is going to do about it, which is where we'll go in a second. But I'm going to say, tell you point blank, I did not see it happen, and I did not watch the video, even though it's, of course, everywhere and able to be found, because I don't feel the need to, and I don't want to sicken myself with it. I don't need to see a ball smashing a little girl at 105 miles an hour to know that that's horrible. So bear with me if I try to describe this in a way that maybe doesn't suit your satisfaction or doesn't satisfy you or suit you because, like I said, I just didn't feel the need to see it. Her face and head were bloodied by that, by the ball, as we know. Her father carried her out immediately, as we said. She immediately got taken to a hospital. The players described after the game that they still have knots in their stomach. Brian Dozier, the second baseman of the Twins, literally said after the game, telling reporters, and this is innings later now when the game is over, said he still has a knot in his stomach. He said, I never look, and for some reason I did. He doesn't look at foul balls that go into the stands, he means. And this time he did. And he saw it right in the face, a little kid, and it sickened him. So many other players, again, Todd Frazier was on one knee and praying. He said after the game that he has two young children under the age of three. And so he knows how this would affect him if it had been one of his children. Just a simply horrific thing, which has prompted what has been a long, long discussion through the years, and it really seems to ratchet up this discussion of protective netting every time one of these tragedies happens. And then after a few days of sports talk and a few days of sports columns in local newspapers saying, boy, baseball has to do something, put up a net or something, people forget. Time goes on, more games are played, home runs happen, victories happen, pennant races are tightened. Life intervenes, and people forget about it, and they go right back to their business until it happens again. It's time. It's time to stop this charade of this faux outrage, this charade of concern, this pretension of, you know, willingness to change things, to protect fans. It's time to stop that. We can't just talk about this on talk radio for 2 or 3 days, have a few columns written about it, have a couple of people do a rant on Facebook, and then come, you know, what is today, Thursday? You know, come Tuesday, everybody's back into, boy, you know, there's only 1 week of baseball left, and, you know, the pennant races are tightening, and who's going to be in the wild card, and nobody's going to be talking about that little girl. Nobody's going to be talking about Todd Frazier's concern and his anguish on his face. Nobody's going to be talking about, should we put up nets? This will be over in a few days. That can't happen this time around, right? This can not happen any longer. The argument, as I understand it, against putting up protective netting, and I've listened to all of the arguments that people have made, the argument against putting up protective netting all the way down the baselines in baseball is that it will interrupt the fans' experience with the game. They want to be as close to the action as possible. They want to feel like it, and if they're forced to sit behind a net, they won't like it as much. It will limit the fans' enjoyment of the game, and that's something baseball doesn't want to mess with because they charge buku bucks for those seats down the baselines, as you know. And if the fans aren't going to enjoy them as much and aren't going to buy them as much, well, that's just you know, something we can't afford. We're going to take chances with people's lives, with people's health, with little kids, with older seniors. We're going to take chances with them in order to make sure that we continue to drive the revenue that comes from the seats down the first and third base lines, particularly behind the dugouts where some of those line shots are on you in a blink. In fact, don't blink. In fact, don't look down at your phone for a second to plan a selfie. Don't try to take a picture of the batter, because in the time it takes you to put the phone up and snap the shot, the line drive could be sliced or pulled right at you. And if not at you, at your toddler. Even if you are the perfect baseball fan who would never look away from the action and take their eyes off a pitched ball, which essentially you have to do. I mean, we do understand this, right? You do understand that when you're at a baseball game, a Major League Baseball game, and you are down one of the lines, particularly behind the dugout area, you realize that you pretty much are forbidden from looking over at the cotton candy guy and putting your hand in the air and saying, "Over here!" Because while you're looking at him, there's a pitch being made, and there's a potential swing being made, and it's a ball that could be right at your face. While you're digging into your pocket to pull out your $10 beer or your $10 bill to buy your $8 beer from the vendor guy, another pitch is being made. As a matter of fact, that vendor is in harm's way because his back is to the field while he gives you your $2 change. And a line drive could hit him in the back of his skull and kill him. But even if you are being a perfect baseball fan and you don't buy things from vendors while pitches are happening, and you don't look at your phone to check in at Comerica, taking a little pic of you or doing a selfie with you and your little one to show everybody where we are, go Tigers, or out at Progressive, go Indians, go Tribe. Even if you don't do those things which distract you from the field of play, it's entirely possible that you can't stop the damage that's headed your way anyway. I can guarantee you, glove on her hand or no glove, and think about that. What percentage, Kush, if you had to put on it, what percentage of baseball fans do you think wear gloves to games?
Ooh, that to put a number on it, I'd say my guess from the last game I was at a couple weeks ago, 10%, and that feels down since I was a kid.
Yeah, I was going to say the same thing. Maybe 10, maybe 15% of the fans take gloves to games. But even if you had one, first of all, are you ever going to take it off? When you're digging into your purse, ma'am, for your money, or you're giving the two-year-old that you're with something to play with, or whatever the case might be, even if you had a glove, you're not going to have it on every pitch. Secondly, put a glove on the hand of my wife. If there is a line drive off the bat of Todd Frazier coming for my wife at 105 miles an hour, glove or no glove, she's not stopping it. Why? Because she's not a major leaguer. I am not a major leaguer. I feel like I'd have a fighting chance if I was watching every pitch and I had the glove on my hand, and if it was coming from me or from my child's face, I would be able to react in time. And if I couldn't catch it, at least put the leather on it and knock it out of the way. I feel like I might be able to. But you know what? I'd be willing to say that 75 to 80% of the fans behind the first base line dugout or third base dugout couldn't. At 105 miles an hour, can you blink? I mean, honestly, just blink your eyes, and that's how long it's going to take that ball to be on you or your child. What if you take your father to the game? What if you're 55 and your father's 85? Dad, going to take you to the ball game. We're going to go watch the Tigers and Twins today. Thanks, son. That'll be great. Old times. Chances are 85-year-old Pops doesn't have the reflexes that he did when he was 30-year-old Pops, and you weren't born yet. He's going to wear that, and it could kill him. Are we willing to take all of those risks continually in the interest of profit? Because baseball fans may not like looking through the net. The obvious response to that is, which are the most expensive seats in most baseball parks? Are they the ones in center field? Nope. Are they the ones down the first baseline that we're talking about? No, although they're close. Generally speaking, the most expensive tickets in a baseball park are where, Jim Cushlin?
That would be behind the plate.
Yeah, home plate. And what are those fans sitting behind home plate in the most expensive seats in the house looking through to see the baseball game?
That would be a net.
A protective net. The idea that fans will stop coming to games because of nets down the first and third base line, rather than being comfortable in their in the security and the safety that that net provides, to me is one of the most ludicrous arguments I've ever heard anyone make. Back in 2002, Jim, in Columbus, Ohio, at a Blue Jackets game, we all remember this terrible story. A young 16-year-old girl, a teenager, whole life in front of her at a Blue Jackets game at Nationwide Arena. Brittany Cecil was her name. Was struck in the face by a puck that came flying into the stands. It hit her, and it killed her. Immediately, NHL said, oh my God, never again. Mandatory netting was installed at the beginning of the very next season at the ends of every arena. Both ends behind each goal. And extending down a little bit toward the straightaway of the oval. Every arena in hockey. And Jim, I was doing a little bit of checking to see if I could find the statistics on attendance in the 2001-2002 season, which is when that happened with Brittany Cecil in Columbus. And today, or in the years after, there has been no measurable drop-off at all. Now, there have been some drop-offs in hockey attendance, but they have been due to strikes and work stoppages
right.
And everything else in 2005 and then in 2013. When work stoppages happen, fans get mad, and attendance slumps for a while after that. We all know this happens.
Right, yep.
But there has been no measurable drop in attendance from fans at hockey games because, oh, my God, I've got to look through a net to see the ice. The fans might have griped about it for a week or two, and then they just didn't notice it anymore. The same thing would happen if baseball was smart and cared about their fans. The same thing would happen. Fans will complain for a little while and go, my God, look at this view. It's terrible. I got this net in my way. Why I'm seeing a net and I can't. It'll last for a week. It'll last for 2 weeks, maybe. Hell, maybe a month. But after a month, the griping and the moaning will stop. And people will never know it wasn't there. Just like fans behind home plate never noticed the net there. They're just glad when a batter swings and fouls one straight back as it comes at them, even though the net is there, what do we do? What do we do?
Still flinch a little.
We flinch. I guess flinch is the best way to say it, but, you know, we kind of recoil. Put your hands up in front of your face. You pull your face back and turn away. Instinctively, even though there's a net there. And they never think, boy, I wish a net wasn't there so I could see the game more clearly. They're thankful the net stopped the ball from coming at them. And the same thing would happen if they put it down both lines to protect those players behind the dugouts and beyond. The same thing would happen. It's time for baseball to stop monkeying around before somebody gets killed. And a fan, by the way, did get killed by a foul ball. I was tweeting about this last night, and somebody pointed out it did happen in 1970. So I wasn't aware of that. But, I mean, how many more bullets do we have to dodge? A 2-year-old got struck in the face yesterday. How many more of those do we have to have happen before there's a funeral for one of them? And then baseball says, okay, can we be proactive instead of reactive for a change, Rob Manfred? Mandate it. Owners, get together and say, that's it. Netting down every baseline to the end of the dugout and probably beyond at least where the camera bays are, where the real damage can be done with line drives that go into the stands. I would like to talk about it with you, but I can't because I got to get to a sports center here at the top of the hour. Jim, who was our winner? I'm looking and I don't see.
Okay.
I mean, we got a winner for him, or did you already turn that one into?
No, I still have it right here. Adam McKee of Toledo is going to see Sammy Hagar.
Congratulations to Adam McKee. Don't forget, we're going to qualify another person for the European Flyaway coming up a little bit later on in this hour. Paul Keels joins us after the break on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
That's Drill in the gap, right center field. That'll get down and go to the wall. The Indians will score first once again. Santana around third comes home. Jason Kipnis with his 23rd double of the year, and that has to feel really good for him.
Happening during the course of the game.
Lindor launches one deep center. Back is Trout. He's out of room. It's out of here. Frankie Lindor with a big blast into the cheap seats. A two-run homer here in the seventh to make it 4-2 Cleveland. His 31st home run of the year.
It's almost like he knew it was coming.
Shaw, 2-2 pitch, swung out and missed. He struck him out to end the game. The Indians have their 95th victory of the season. They've won 26 of their last 27 and a new franchise record with their 13th consecutive win on the road.
Yeah, and I hate that comment where people say they stay within themselves, because you can stay within yourself and right out of the league like me. But when you have talent, the moment's not too big for him. You see, it seems like you see the best of his talent. I know we feel good when he comes up. We did a lot of good things tonight, because I thought they did a lot of good things. I mean, that was a fun game to be a part of. That looked like two teams that really wanted to win.
We had our hands full. That's mainly what we're focusing on right now. Coming up with that plan and then implementing it today in meetings and in practice. You know, big challenge for us. The whole team's playing really good. Yeah, you just do. You just change the channel. We're going from one scheme to another. Change our scheme to adapt, improvise, adjust. Go with the guy that's got the hot hand. You've seen us. That's what we've done with the running back position. Ty's a starter. Chris and Karan are gonna play in every single game. So, yeah, I don't see it as the same as the quarterback position or the punt return position.
What did you like about winning the game on Saturday?
We won. You know, that's his number one job. Took care of the football. Made some courageous throws in the pocket, accurate throws in tight windows, and you know, a lot of things.
It's coordinated. I mean, that's a big part of our getting ready for this game is the continual growth of pass defense, of execution of our pass game, of playing with rhythm and tempo on offense. Those are all areas that's part of our game plan. So to answer your question, it's a mix of both. They're primarily a four-down defense. We haven't seen that in a couple weeks. Getting ready for that because it's a new defense, and then also just working our weaknesses. And it's good to have both. You know, I've had that before. We have different skill sets at quarterback, and they're somewhat different. I don't know if it's drastically different, but somewhat different. So we just have – the good thing is we have it all. It's just getting them ready to – so when you script plays, okay, Dwayne, you're in, and go. And Joe Burrow's – he's about 90%. He's been cleared to play. He's still not 100%, but he's involved in that. And he's probably in between the skill sets.
This is the Bob France Afternoon Extravaganza on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Onward now. It's 13 minutes after 4. Thanks for joining us on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket on this Thursday. I told you we had two of the greatest voices in college sports. We talked to one of them last hour. His name is Jim Brandstatter. He's the voice of the Michigan Wolverines, talking about their Big Ten season opener against Purdue. And now we go to the other. He is our weekly guest, Paul Keels, right here on the Ohio State Radio Network, including ESPN 106.5 The Ticket. Joining us now to preview the Buckeyes in week number 4. And Mr. Keels, Mr. Brandstatter said, please offer a hearty hello to Mr. Keels for him. So please consider yourself helloed.
Well, thank you. And I knew Jim way back in the 80s when I worked in the Detroit market. And as good an announcer as he is, and I think he deserves an awful lot of credit for how he has improved his play-by-play announcing, falling into a big role. But he's even that much better of a person. He really is, and I appreciate you passing that along very much.
Well, that's really great to hear you say, too, because he is a terrific broadcaster as well. We really, you know, enjoy listening to his games, as of course we do yours. And, of course, as you know, he does the Lions as well. So that's a busy weekend when he's got the Wolverines at Purdue Saturday, and then he's got to be back at Ford Field for the Lions and the Falcons on Sunday. And if he's as good of a person as or a better person than a broadcaster, then he must be salt of the earth.
And was an outstanding TV announcer for a long time in the Detroit market, too.
So, yeah, so going from that into the play-by-play realm and being as great as he is, that is certainly a career, certainly well-lived, well and, of course, continuing to go on. Okay, Paul, speaking of great football and great football voices, let's borrow yours now and see if you can give us a little bit of your thoughts on the righting of the ship after the Oklahoma loss. And we talked at length about what some of the problems were while also giving due credit to a very, very good Oklahoma team after week number two. Urban got the guys together and took Army apart pretty handily at 38-7 last week. What was what stood out to you the most?
Well, I think the fact that they were able to really not give up any big, massive, or as Urban called them, free plays against Army. And they didn't get too terribly burned by that triple option in the wishbone. And, you know, the scary part about that, listening to coaches talk about it, it's something that you're not going to see all the time. And you know, I think we talked last week about how they've been practicing some option stuff as far back as spring football just to be ready for it. And I think the fact that, you know, they were able to not get burned too much, they yielded a 99-play drive against Army, but that was really it. And offensively, I think you saw them, you know, get their group back together, throwing the football, JT Barrett spreading it around to a bunch of different people, J.K. Dobbins running like we've come to expect him to in a very short period of time, and just by, you know, by and large, just get that good feeling back of winning again.
Yeah, and we can't really go too much further without JT. You mentioned him spreading the ball around. He had something to answer, as you know. I mean, there's been some critics after last season about accuracy and whether he's ready to take Ohio State to the next step, which is not only into the playoffs but to a championship, and whether he's the guy. Then Oklahoma happened, and there were some mistakes there. How would you describe his response to that with the game against Army?
Well, I think his response has always been the same, and one of the things that's made him so good is his consistency. You'll hear JT Barrett talk even after victories about how he has to work at getting better and dissecting things and each every little thing, and a lot like coaches, focusing on more on what didn't go well as opposed to what did go well. So I think it was a good answer. I think it certainly was a nice thing to see him eventually set a record that we knew was coming, the Big Ten record for touchdowns responsible for. And also to see him run the football a little more, whether they were by design or plays that had broken down and gave him the opportunity to run. So I think it was good to see him just kind of get back out there and be the JT we've seen most of his career, and also kind of really keep the offense on point, keep them together. You know, they didn't run as much up-tempo stuff as, you know, maybe they will later on in the season, but, you know, to see him throw the ball accurately, both long and short, and, you know, he talked about some of the misses that are out there. But he's a guy that's always going to be focused on getting better, regardless of what the outcome is.
By the way, 25 out of 33 might have answered at least some of the critics as far as accuracy. A very, very great completion percentage in the game for 270 and two touchdowns. You also heard, at least I think you did, but you were on hold at the time, Paul, a little bit of Urban's commentary this week on the quarterbacks, on JT, on Dwayne, and the different scenarios in which you know each might be used. He even mentioned Joe Burrow, who's about 90%. Effectiveness or health back from his injured hand. So is that an indication, and we know Dwayne went 4-for-4 in his limited duty this past week as well, is that an indication that there may be more use for those guys in certain circumstances, or is this still going to be JT until there's garbage time?
I think that's probably what it is right now, Bob. You know, first and foremost, just to see Dwayne Haskins get on the field for the first time in a real game.
Yeah,
it's an accomplishment. And, you know, the ball looked good coming out of his hand, looked fast. The coaches say that what we saw in limited time was what they see in practice. You know, then they got closer down the field and they didn't really want to run it up anymore, so they kind of shut it down. So, you know, if this game against UNLV plays out according to Hoyle, I think you'll probably see Dwayne get a chance to get out there more. And, you know, a lot of it with Joe Burrow, it's good, number one, that he has been cleared. He's been warming up, even though he hasn't been at the point where they could put him into the game, but it's just kind of know that he's taken that next step. You know, here's a guy that played in 5 or 6 games last year, so it's not going to be a foreign concept to him. You know, he presents, at least from what we've seen at times, in mop-up time last year and in the spring game, he presents a running threat also. So, you know, there's a few different dynamics that each of those young men present, and hopefully, if things play out the way we think they will, not only against Vegas, but then maybe even next week against Rutgers, there'll be opportunity for them to get out there. But, you know, as we talked last week, I think everybody realizes that for this team to be successful and go to places where they want to go, it's going to involve JT Barrett having to play at a high level.
Paul, we're talking to Paul Keels, of course, the voice of the Buckeyes, for his regular Thursday visit with us in advance of the Buckeyes game. But we're still looking back at last week. One more thought on that. J.K. Dobbins carried 13 times for 172 yards and a couple of touchdowns. Looked much, much more like J.K. Dobbins that we saw in the opener against Indiana. And Mike Weber carried 4 times for 13 yards. Is the Mike Weber era as the starting running back for the Buckeyes? Sorry, I had Barant center on for the Buckeyes over already, or is this still a he's not healthy thing? When he is, he will get the ball.
More of the latter. They felt good about him going into the game, but apparently during the game, that hamstring kind of tugged on him a little bit. And reading between the lines, Bob, I think a lot of this is all precaution. Because Urban Meyer has talked about how there's going to be a need for Mike Weber to be at his full strength late in the season. You know, when the weather turns, they're going to need two guys. And they also were still minus DeMario McCall. They thought he was making some progress this week, but that sports hernia has kind of jumped up and given him a little more trouble this week. Antonio Williams has looked good in the select moments he's been out there, and he got some mop-up time last week. Mm-hmm. You know, he scored twice against Indiana. But Mike Weber is not forgotten. He's not out of the picture. This seems to be, again, and we're reading between the lines, they just want to get him to where he's as close to 100% as he can be with a hamstring before they really start stretching him out an awful lot.
When he is 100%, Paul, how would you predict? I mean, that's all we can do is speculate here. You're not in Urban's head or anybody else's. But when he's full strength and J.K. Dobbins is full strength and continuing to gain experience while Mike is down or hampered, is it a 50-50 thing, or is it just going to be a week-to-week thing and a gut feeling for who Urban sends out into that huddle to take these carries, or how do you think he'll deal with that?
The guess, Bob, would be that a lot of it's going to just involve the feel of that particular game. Mm-hmm. If a guy gets a hot hand, certainly they're going to ride him for a while. Not unlike what we saw with Beanie Wells and Antonio Pittman some years ago. A little bit like the one season started out with Carlos Hyde and Ezekiel Elliott, and then Hyde kind of took charge. So I think it's going to be, they'll probably have an idea going in, but also trying to, if Dobbins in one game gets rolling and on a real good roll, they'll stick more with him. If Weber, given healthy, if he starts running like he did last year and being able to get over 1,000 yards, he'll get his opportunities. This all seems to be about more than anything health.
Yeah, and I certainly hope that is the case, because I don't know, I've got a soft spot, if you will, for Mike Weber. Certainly, I want to see J.K. Dobbins do well as well. And DeMario McCall, if he ends up getting carries, and Williams and all the rest. But, you know, Weber's recruitment story was one of the more interesting ones we've seen in recent years, going from Detroit to, you know, Cass Tech to deciding to come to Ohio State and everything that went along with it. And he had such a great year last year, and I was really hoping that he continues to grow in his role. So we'll see where that goes. Paul, let's look ahead now at a team that is, you know, it's interesting. I was looking on one of the Buckeyes websites. I can't remember which one, but it put a little piece together saying, let the Buckeyes video team show you how to prepare for a 40-point underdog. You can't go into a game overconfident. You have to be ready to do your job, or even a 40-point underdog can be dangerous. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think if you ask UNLV, because they were about a 45-point favorite against Howard, and they got upset at home by Howard. So, you know, coaches are always looking for whatever angle. And, you know, with Vegas, really, you look at some of their key offensive players. You know, they've got a record-setting receiver in Devontae Boyd, who's had, I think it's 13 100-yard receiving games. A running back, Lexington Thomas, who is really, in a short span here, broken off big plays, showed some sizzle last year as well. And a redshirt freshman quarterback who, coming into the season, was battling with two experienced quarterbacks and won the job. So they've got some sizzle on offense. Defensively, they're a little deficient by Big Ten standards, although Coach Meyer on his radio show today mentioned that they've got a couple of interior linemen that people are telling them they think are NFL body types. So, you know, it's one of those where, and honestly, I was thinking about this before you called, Bob. What we're looking at now with Army and UNLV is kind of typical of what we see normally at the start of non-conference season, rather than having Indiana and Oklahoma. So, you know, the coaching staff's always going to be pushing that little message about it's about us getting better, it's about us doing what it is that we want to do. And if they want to, you know, get caught up in the point spread, once again, all they got to do is point to what happened to UNLV in their first game at home.
Great point, as always. And, Paul, last thing before you go, just looking at the national scene, how about Clemson? Up to number two in the national poll. Some say they may be better than Alabama. What they were able to do in taking apart the defending Heisman Trophy winner. And, by the way, Lamar Jackson's loss there may have made Archie Griffin safe yet again for another year. but, boy, Clemson looks fantastic even without Deshaun Watson.
You know, no surprising that defensively they do. But, you know, I think with a new quarterback fitting into all of the other pieces they have, they're just on such a roll of confidence right now. Clearing Louisville was huge. You know, I think that Dabo Swinney probably doesn't get the credit he deserves for the coaching job that he's done consistently. You know, remember when Dabo took over there and it was a mid-season change, he had never even been a coordinator. So this is a guy that I think probably needs to have the horns blowed a little louder for him with what he's done. And, you know, he seems from, you know, being around his press conferences the last few years when Ohio State's played him, he's a guy that exudes confidence, and that seems to rub off on his players. So I think they've got a pretty good machine rolling there, and a lot of it is because of that outstanding defense they present.
Do you have any problem right now? And I think you and I are like-minded in terms of rankings at this stage of a season, but, you know, we are going into week four now for most everybody. So right now through 3 weeks and going into week four, do you have a problem with where what the top five looks like, or where Ohio State is in relation to Michigan, Wisconsin? The Big Ten kind of has, four of the top ten now. Penn State is fourth in both polls. Then you got Michigan at eight, and then Wisconsin and Ohio State flopping at 9 and 10 in the two different polls. All look about decent to you, Paul?
Yeah, I think so. And as you said, Bob, some of this will take care of itself. You know, we'll know a little more about Penn State after they play at Iowa this weekend. You know, obviously, you know, Michigan going to Purdue, you know, that's a game I think has got more curiosity, but I don't know how much a win there, is going to help them as far as national rankings. And, you know, as we've talked about over the years, the Big Ten situation will take care of itself, with where people are ranked. But no, not really. I think, you know, you're still looking at, you know, if Alabama were to stumble, that certainly opens the way for Clemson and or Oklahoma to get up there.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think we're all kind of curious now to start seeing the competition within conference play be a little more stiffer for some of these teams we're talking about.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's really fascinating to look at the fact that, as I said, that four Big Ten teams are in the top ten. It doesn't mean a whole lot right now, but it just really signals the rise and the return to prominence after, you know, the last several years being all about SEC this, and it's a speed game now, and the Big Ten, the sluggish guys in the Big Ten, the big, you know, corn-fed mules in the Midwest, they're not able to do it anymore. And boy, things really seem to have turned around as Big Ten football is about as good as it gets. Paul, great stuff as always. Thank you so much for the time. Have a great call against UNLV, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds good, Bob. Have a good weekend.
Thank you, sir. Have a great one. There you go. Paul Keels joining us right here on ESPN 106.5. The Ticket with a football preview of the Buckeyes and the Running Rebs coming up. Again, it's a 40-point dog are the Rebels. But, you know, Ohio State has to take everyone seriously, as Paul pointed out, with UNLV and Howard. Okay, you know what time it is. It is now 4:27. Oh, just flipped over to 4:28, and it's about that time of day when we tell you about your chance to qualify for the Ticket's European vacation. That's right. You could fly to one of six European destinations from Toledo Express Airport via Charlotte, North Carolina. To qualify, all you got to do is dial right now, 866-240-1065, and be caller number 5. We'll do this once a day at about this time every afternoon on the Extravaganza, or you can register one time at 1065theticket.com. It's all brought to you by Toledo Express Airport, Toledo Port Authority, American Airlines, and Toledo Sports Leader, ESPN 1065 The Ticket. Good luck to you. All right, going to get a timeout now. On the other side of the bottom of the hour Sports Center, I want to talk more about the baseball netting issue and the tragedy that happened last night, just a horrific story that we saw there. But we are also going to talk about a local boy done good. He's in the record books. Not the NFL record books, not even the NCAA record books, but he's in the Guinness Book of World Records. We'll tell you about that story and talk to him coming up right here on ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Once again, it's the Bob France Extravaganza, ESPN 106.5 The Ticket.
Yes, indeed. It is the Extravaganza rolling onward on this Thursday afternoon. Thanks for being with us. 22 minutes of outstanding awesome left in the program. We'll have Mr. Miller's awesomeness coming up with Drive Time at 5 o'clock. All right. One of the most underappreciated and disrespected. That's the word I'm looking for. And not disrespected, just really not paid attention to skills on a football field. The long snapper, the special teams stud, the guy who has to make sure that the game-winning field goal can even be tried because he's got the perfect snap, or the very important punt on field position. It's just people don't talk about it. You know what it is? The long snapper is the referee. And what I mean by that is the guy who's never noticed until he does something wrong. If a guy blows a call, you're on the referee. If the guy makes the right calls, nobody says a word. You just, he's invisible. You can make the same thing about an offensive lineman in general. When he holds, you got him and you know about him. If he doesn't hold, you ignore him because he's not important. You just look at the ball carrier. Well, that's the long snapper. You never notice him until he snaps one over somebody's head. Well, this story is an interesting one because this guy's goal was to snap the ball over everybody's head, 34 yards deep, as a matter of fact. Perrysburg High School graduate Jace Whitner managed to set a world record this past Friday with the longest snap in Guinness history. And he joins us now to talk about this incredible accomplishment right here on the ticket. Jace, thanks for the time, man. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. Hey, what year did you graduate?
I graduated with the class of 2017, so just recently.
Oh, so you just graduated. Okay.
I did,
so,
yep.
So are you in your first year of college, or what's going on with you?
No, I'm working right now.
You're working? Then,
yep, I'm going to attend a prep school in next fall.
Good on you. Good for you, young man. That's awesome. Okay, I didn't realize you were just a brand new recent graduate. So
yeah.
let's talk about this thing. I mean, so you were the long snapper for Perrysburg, yes?
I was, yep.
How many times were you noticed for the wrong reason, as I just talked about? Did you ever have that bad snap at the wrong time, or was this your thing and you were always clutch?
You know, I guess I was always clutch. I didn't have a bad snap all last year. Coach Kriegel gave me props on that at our award banquet, and it was pretty cool to get noticed for something like that.
How young were you when you started long snapping? Because, you know, most football teams, especially like, you know, in junior high or if you start, when did you start? What was your first year of football?
My first year of football was fifth grade.
Fifth grade. So usually at that time, you know, when there's punt team, you know, coaches are like, can anybody snap? Can anybody put it 10 yards behind them? How young were you when you first started doing that?
I actually started my junior year.
Really? You never long snapped until your junior year?
No.
How'd you get drafted into that job?
Coach Kriegel needed a long snapper, so I tried it out and I stuck with it, and I guess I got pretty good at it. So
wow.
I started.
So I mean, did you ever do it just messing around or screwing around before practice? I mean, how did you know that you'd be the guy to step up and do it when Coach Kriegel said, "I need somebody"?
Well, I guess. I guess I don't really know.
so he coach just said, "I need a volunteer," and you said, "I'll do it," and you were good at it.
Basically.
Yeah, that's amazing. Like I said, it's kind of the way it is in young football, but I guess it's that way sometimes in high school. Usually every class, don't they? Like when you were a sophomore and a freshman, who did the long snapping on the JV team or the freshman team?
Well, my junior year, it was the backup quarterback.
Okay.
I didn't play my sophomore year. I unfortunately had a pretty bad concussion at the end of my freshman year. But I think it was the backup quarterback or the backup center or the center.
The only reason I ask is usually, like in most schools and most systems and districts, you know, you go through every class has somebody who can do it. You know, there's a freshman,
right.
Whoever the freshman long snapper is ends up being the long snapper on the JV team, and then whoever it is on the varsity graduates, he moves up and becomes that. And there's always somebody cycling through, so it's kind of neat how you just, you know, started as a junior and got so good at it. Now let's move on to the record. When did you become aware that there was such a thing as longest long snap ever?
It was April of 2016. Actually, I'm sorry. It was April. It was this year, actually.
This year. Okay, so just a few years ago. About, what, 5
years
ago?
Yeah, and, yep. And then I looked into it because I saw it on Facebook, and I looked into it, and I saw it was 30 yards. And I went to go try it. I didn't get it the first time. It's really far. It's It's double what.
What a regular
it is
punch
in an actual
punch
game.
Snap is, right?
Yeah,
punch snap's about 15.
Yeah, and then I didn't get it the first couple of times, and then one day, you know, I just started in 30, 31, and then I just started to do it. So
now, Jace, tell us, we're talking to a Perrysburg High graduate, 2017 Perrysburg High graduate, Jace Whitner, former long snapper for the football team, who is now in the record books, and we'll talk about the record again in a minute, but were there any parameters? In other words, did it just have to go past 30 yards, or did it have to hit a certain target or land within a certain area, or could it be
it just had to go? It just had to go 30 yards. Nate Boyer said it, so it just had to go over 30 yards.
And that's a pro. That's a former Seahawk Nate Boyer, right?
Yep.
So a pro long snapper went 30, and you said, I'm 17 years old, I played high school football, I snapped for 2 years, and I can beat that. And then you set out to do that, right?
Yep.
So what did you do when you decided, I want to do this? I mean, do you just pick up the phone and call Mr. Guinness? How do you make that happen?
Well, there's a process that we had to go through. It required, we had to wait. It said 9 weeks, but it actually took 12 weeks. Mm-hmm. We had to fill out an application, and then after that 12 weeks, they got accepted. And then my mom and I found people to,
to witness it, or?
Witnesses, two photographers, or people taking pictures, people taking video, mm-hmm. and then the two independent witnesses. So it was a lot. It really was a lot.
So you had to send all of that in then for them to approve, or did somebody from the Guinness Book of World Records actually have to come and watch you do it in person?
What we did was we sent in video and all the evidence. To have a judge there from Guinness would be $10,000, so my mom and I decided to forego the $10,000.
Well, as long as they'll accept it the way you said, two witnesses, independent people, and video evidence and everything else, I suppose that's a pretty good way to do it. Back, before the age of everybody having a video camera in their pocket by way of their phone is probably a little bit tougher for people to set these kinds of records in years gone by. So how did it feel? I mean, you know, you're spread over the ball, and you've got to hike this thing, you know, double what a normal punch snap would be, and when you finally did it and you nailed 31, 32, and all the way to 34, I mean, what'd that feel like?
You know, it really felt good. I did it for, there was a reason why I did it, and it wasn't for me. It wasn't to make a name for myself. It was for the kids that, you know, get bullied and, you know, they get picked on all the time, because I was in their shoes when I was younger. So it was for to put in their name, you know, whoever it is out there. It was for them, and, you know, when I hit it, when I got 34 yards, I really felt good about myself.
Wow. You should be. I mean, that's fantastic. I didn't know that part of your story, that this was, kind of with kids in mind, kids who struggle and who get bullied, and this is
right.
Kind of a mark for them. Good for you. You said you struggled with that a little bit when you were younger?
Yeah, it started elementary school, and it led up to high school, you know. I got through it,
How'd you get through it? What'd you do?
You know, I didn't really go to anybody. I talked to my parents, but it was really tough, you know, to go through. And I know it's a world problem right now.
Yeah, it is. I think it always has been. I think it's more known now because, social media, there's a different type of bullying there
right.
that goes on as you live your life in front of everybody's eyes by way of cameras and tweets and posts and snaps
right.
and everything else. But it has been a problem for a lot of people, and that's an inspirational thing you did. So now you're in the Guinness Book of World Records. Well, is there still a Guinness Book of World Records, or is it now just the Guinness website of World Records?
I think they still got the books.
Do they?
Yeah, I think 2018's out right now, so I should be in the 2019 one.
And do they send you one of those once you get in, or do you have to buy it?
You know, I know I for sure get a plaque.
Okay.
I not sure about a book.
They better give you a copy of the book, for crying out loud. You're in it. You contributed to it. They ought to hook you up with at least that, right?
Yeah, that'd be cool.
When I was your age, not that you care, but many, I'm more than twice your age, but when I was your age, there was no internet. I used to look at those books all the time, and you flip through, because I'm a sports guy, obviously, and I would go to, the sports records, and, the tallest basketball player, and the longest drive of a golf ball, and all these other kinds of things. I never saw longest long snap before. How old is that category? Is it? I mean, was it set for the very first time by Boyer? Or?
Yeah, he did it last. It was before. It was during a Super Bowl festivity type thing. So it was. It was. He said it in 2016.
So he essentially set the very first one. He didn't break the long snap record.
Right.
It wasn't one. He set it. Is essentially
right. Yeah. He set it.
So anything he snapped really would have been the winner. I mean, he could have snapped it 22 yards and it would have been the winner, right?
Yeah, basically.
Well, he had it easy, man. He didn't even have anything to shoot for. You had to go past 30. You had a harder job.
Yeah.
Well, you did it. Congratulations. And now here's the thing. Are you into the tit for tat thing? If you see some clown from Missouri saying, I can go 35 and does it, are you going to get back out there and say, I want my damn record back and go 36 or 37?
Nah, they can have it. You know,
done now if somebody breaks it?
I actually got asked that question today at work, and it's just really cool to be a part of Guinness. And if they want to go beat 34, which I'm sure somebody probably already has, but they can have it.
Well, you know, that's a great attitude. You did it, and you did it for a personal reason as well, just to kind of say, I want to do something public for all the kids who suffered through some of the things that I did, and you're not gonna be petty about it. And make sure you go out there and keep your record. So I respect
you.
Well, hey, Jace, listen, man, congratulations. Congrats on being a grad of Perrysburg from this year.
Thank you.
Good luck in your work, and good luck with prep school or wherever it is that you go in the future. It's a great thing you did. Your name's going to be in that Guinness Book of World Records, and that's something nobody can ever take away.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Good for you, man. Thank you, Jace.
Yeah, thank you.
Jace Whitner from Perrysburg. How about it? 34-yard long snap. Like I said before the interview, and anybody who knows football knows it already, of course, but it's just one of those unsung hero things. Nobody knows about the long snapper until the long snapper screws up. You bounce one back on the game-winning field goal attempt, you are the GOAT. And we don't mean GOAT as it's come to be known in 2017, greatest of all time. You're wearing the GOAT horns. You sail one over the punter's head deep in your own end zone, and it's a safety. You are the GOAT. The wrong kind of goat. Nobody notices this long snapper until he screws up. So that's just a very, very cool story. And he only did it starting as a junior, he said, too. That's one of those, that's a little trippy. Usually teams have, like I said, punt snappers and punters, specialists. Long snappers, punters, and place kickers and kickoff guys generally work their way up through, the ranks. You do it in eighth grade, you do it for your freshman team, you do it for your sophomore or your JV team. In normal circumstances, and then whenever the graduate goes, then you step in and you do it. So how about that? Jace came out of nowhere and just did it. That's a very, very cool story. All right. And by the way, the part about the Guinness Book of World Records, too, I literally did not know they still made them. I have seen the online Guinness Book, and you can search. It's a little bit easier than trying to flip through 6,000 pages. I mean, the Guinness Book of World Records, when I was a kid, Cush, and did you ever partake in this when you were young?
I had one when I was young, yeah.
Did you?
Yeah, I never got one. I thumbed through it every now and again. I have no idea where it is, though.
So you actually bought one?
I actually had one of the little books at one point, but first of all, I bet half the records don't exist anymore. That's assuming I could even find the darn thing.
Yeah, I never had one. I always went to the school library
and
checked it out and would look through it and see all those things that I was telling. I mean, some of them we all remember, the tallest person in the world, this, that, and the other. But I always go to the sports ones to see what the records were in sports.
Yeah. I did that too.
And that Guinness book back then was, I mean, it was like as thick as a Manhattan phone book. I mean, it was huge. And I can only imagine now, 30 years, 35, whatever it is, years later, from those days, what it's like. And I guess that's why the website is probably better. But what a cool story. I didn't know that part of his story, too, the fact that he wanted to kind of gain some notoriety, not for himself, not to say, look at me, I'm awesome, but to say, hey, I'm doing this for kids, you know, who have been dealing with some things. I've dealt with those things as well, and this is for you. Keep your chin up, that sort of thing. I think it's a great message.
No, that absolutely is, you know, to have that kind of message along with it. Very good one, especially since, you know, he had told us he had some of those issues personally while growing up. So something to help out others. And you get your name in the Guinness Book of World Records, too. Even if somebody breaks it in a year, you'd still have it. That's something I can't say.
He's a better guy than I am because I'm petty. I asked him if he was, you know, tit for tat. I mean, if I break a world record and I'm in the Guinness Book of World Records, for as goofy as it might be, damn it, I want to stay there. And if somebody goes 35 to my 34, I'm just going to say, KMA, I'm doing 36.
I'd probably lead towards you. I'd probably be the same way. Like, let me get out there. I'm going to have to practice for a whole 2 weeks. Then I'll get out there and try again.
Absolutely. I mean, and you know what's really weird? And I don't mean to beat all this to death here, especially as we get winding down the show to drive time. But I don't know about you, Jim, but I shouldn't even say this because I don't want to disparage anything because I know I'm wrong about it, too. But I feel like it's not that hard. I feel like it should be easy. I mean, I don't know about you. I don't know if you've ever long snapped. Now, I don't do the two-hand long snap the way a punch snapper does.
I did as a kid a couple times, never in a game or even in a formal practice scenario.
Yeah.
And I know I didn't come close to anywhere near 30 yards. I know that.
Well, see, because I would do it just like the quarterback way, you know, with one hand as opposed to two.
Like in a shotgun or something.
Yeah, right, correct, yes, just like that. And I can do a 15-yard snap with one hand pretty good, just, you know. And I want to say that, oh, I can do that. I could go 30 yards. I mean, that's not – I don't believe it. I just feels that way, just thinking about it.
Right, okay.
And the fact that it took him a struggle, he said, to get to 30. You know, he said when Boyer set the 30 and he didn't make it his first time and he had to really practice and work and strengthen, you know, himself and to get it up to 30 and then eventually 31 and topping out at 34, I'm sure it's way harder than it feels like.
Yeah.
Or it just seems like sitting in a chair like I am right now. But it seems like it shouldn't be that hard. Part of me is going to go – and you know what I will bet you? I have no way to win this bet because there's no way to prove anything. But I bet you that there are young guys listening to this show right now in this station who, when they get home, they're going to get a football and they're going to see how far they can chuck.
Oh, yeah, there's going to be a handful of you, and you know who you are.
Yeah, I know who I am because I'm going to do it. I swear to God, I'm going to get my kids football when I go home, and I'm going to try to do it. I'm going to tell them to get back there 15, 20 yards and see if I can reach them and see where it goes. It's just, that's what we do. All right. Hey, congratulations to Jason Nickel of Toledo. He was paying attention. He was caller number 4 when he had to be. And he is our next European flyaway qualifier. We will do that again, qualifier. Did I say qualifier?
I think so.
Works. It actually works.
It does. It is a flyaway.
That's right. You are a qualifier, qualified to be our flyer. Anyway, we'll do it again tomorrow. Always in the 4 o'clock half hour of this show, sometime between 4 and 4:30. And you can also, if you didn't get it, register for that qualifier on our website at 1065theticket.com. Tomorrow is a free-for-all Friday edition of the show, so hope to have you around for that one. And stay where you are, because Mr. Mike Miller is coming up next with... Oh, Mr. Miller's not
in. I'm in for him today.
All right, Kushlin in for Miller. Substitution. Here's Kushlin in for Miller coming up on Drive Time. We'll see you tomorrow.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.